Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here and Chad Marquitz. We are your hosts for this weekend's edition. Also your hosts throughout the week on our website and podcast, kereport.com. A lot of daily editorials and again, a lot of company updates again. So please go back through the week, click on those company updates. And as always, keep in touch with Chad and I through email. All of our email addresses are posted throughout those company postings. We love hearing what all of you think of the companies and what your thoughts are on these markets. Very excited to report that we are kicking off this weekend show with Rick Rule, well known to all of you, investor and speculator, a lot in the resource sector. Now, Rick, it's been a while since I had you back on the show, and I really just wanted to bring everyone up to speed on your thoughts here initially on the precious metals. We'll cover a number of different commodity sectors, but when it comes to gold and silver, they've been in about a year and 3 month correction right now, and the stocks have been crushed, both large cap and small cap stocks. The question that is creeping into some investors' minds is this bull market in gold and silver over? Let's start there. Please share your thoughts, Rick.
Well, the short answer, Corey, is no. A more instructive answer, however, might go into the nuances. The circumstance that we're in is normal and natural in a bull market. This is a cyclical decline in a secular bull market, a statement which I'll defend in a minute. I have been through two prior gold bull markets. The first one beginning in 1970 and ending in 1981. The second one beginning in 2000 and ending in 2011. Note that both of those were 11-year-long affairs. So the duration of a typical bull market is a decade or better. By my counting, we've been into this one for 4 years. So I suggest that we're still in the first half of the bull market. By dimension, too, if you look at this bull market, the metal price has gone from, say, $1,000 an ounce to $1,750 an ounce. The first bull market that I was involved in, the gold price cleared from $35 an ounce, admittedly price controlled, to $850 an ounce. What's that, 24-fold increase something? The second one, perhaps more representative, the gold price went from $256 to $1,900 an ounce. So both by dimension and duration, if history is a precedent, this bull market is less than halfway done. I think it's important to note, too, that if you look on a representative index of gold equities, the best that I know of is the Barron's Gold Mining Index going back 60 years, what you will see is that periodic periods of malaise and decline are normal and natural. I remember my first big one in 1975. The gold price had gone from $35 to $200. And of course, everybody had the courage of a six-fold price increase. And the gold price then in 1975 declined from $200 an ounce to $100 an ounce, which is to say a 50% decline. And the equities fell further. That, of course, shook the faith of many of the so-called faithful. They took advantage of a bottom to get out and missed a market that moved in 5 short years from $100 an ounce to $850 US per ounce. So make no mistake, what we're going through is normal and natural. Let's look, however, Corey, at why we're in a bull market, separate apart from history. What if this one is different? In my experience, and I'm using gold as a sort of a catch-all phrase for precious metals and precious metals equities, the precious metals prices tend to do well when savers and investors are concerned about the security of their savings denominated in fiat instruments. The world's benchmark savings instrument is the U.S. 10-year Treasury. It's the deepest and most liquid market in the world, allegedly the best issuer in the world. I say allegedly, advisedly. But at any rate, it is the marquee savings instrument in the world. Let's look at that instrument with regards to people being concerned about their savings. In the first instance, and we'll come back to negative interest rates later, This instrument pays 125 basis points a year. You give the U.S. government money, and they give you 1.25% a year for 10 years in a currency which they acknowledge is losing purchasing power at the rate of 5.5% a year. In other words, if you give them money, they promise to give you a greater than 4% negative yield every year, cumulatively and compound for 10 years, which means that at the end of the 10-year period, you get back money that has about a third of its purchasing power remaining. So gold is fighting an investment class that guarantees you loss. My friend Jim Grant calls that return-free risk. Let's look into the details of this, why people might be concerned about fiat instruments. The first thing, of course, is quantitative easing. Corey, if you did that, if you printed flex, you would be charged with counterfeiting and you'd be thrown in the slammer. But if you were a congressman or a member of parliament, it would be called policy and you would become reelected. Irrespective of whether you've committed a felony or not, the creation of spurious currency units, irrespective of who creates them, whether it's Corey or Canada, it has the impact, the immediate arithmetic impact of debasing the currency. And of course, makes people concerned about the efficacy of said currency. The second and probably more alarming threat is debt and deficits. I don't know the appropriate Canadian number, but in the United States, merely at the federal level, we owe $29 trillion, $23 trillion net of the size of the Fed balance sheet. But more alarming than that, the off-balance sheet liabilities of the federal government, things like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, the various unfunded trust funds, exceed, by the estimate of the Congressional Budget Office, $120 trillion. So merely at the federal level, not including state and local governments in the United States, we owe $150 trillion. And we propose to service this debt with a federal budget that is in deficit by $3.5 trillion a year. Explain to me how you service $150 trillion a year in debt when you add to it every year by $3 trillion. The third component, which we've discussed a little bit already, is negative real interest rates. The idea that negative real interest rates are a force of nature is farcical. Why would you loan money to another consumer, foregoing your consumption in favor of his or her immediate consumption, and pay them for the privilege? Why would you loan somebody money at 1.5%, knowing that the currency was depreciating at 5.5%, while simultaneously taking the credit risk? This is truly insane. The fourth reason why I think the precious metals bull market will get underway with greater furor, in fact, than when it started, is because the market share of precious metals and precious metals equities is at almost all-time lows. It is estimated that the market share of precious metals and precious metals related securities in the U.S. market is 0.5% of the market capitalization of all savings and investment products in the United States. Now, what's important to note about that is that the three-decade mean market share of precious metals is estimated to be between 1.5% and 2%. So, gold doesn't need to defeat the U.S. dollar. Gold doesn't need to defeat savings bonds. Gold doesn't need to defeat certificates of deposit. All precious metals need to do is recoup their three-decade-long mean market share, and demand for precious metals and precious metals-related investments will triple, which is precisely what I think is going to happen.
Well, Rick, you've set the stage well there, and that gets into some of the questions that we want to ask about. What will it take to get generalist investors interested in the space again? Do you think it'll be something where we see negative real rates continue to punish savings instruments, as you mentioned, with inflation growing faster, much faster than the treasuries, and people may jump out of the bonds or jump out of those into the safe haven aspect of gold? Or do you think it'll be the attractiveness of the miners that pulls in some of the generalists? And what will it take to get their focus out of the FANG stocks and the runaway tech stocks and take a look at the beleaguered mining sector, which has really cleaned up a lot of the sins of the past? What do you think will happen first, a focus on the gold price or a focus on the mining stocks?
Easy answer is I don't know. I think they're different classes of investor. The investor in physical precious metals, in gold at least, is an insurance-style investor, someone who buys precious metals because they are nervous, they're afraid, they want insurance. I count myself partly among that class. I'm in the odd position of owning a fair bit of precious metals, physical precious metals, and hoping the price doesn't go up, because the circumstance that causes their price to go up is fairly dramatic. And that drama is something I prefer not to experience later in life. The precious metals equity investor or speculator is in a very different category. That's a somewhat more aggressive person. And I'm not sure that precious metals mining stocks will compete particularly against general market securities or tech stocks, but they don't have to. Their market share is infinitesimal. You don't need to change a decimal point. You need to change a hundredth of a decimal point in order to have an impact on the market. And I think that's going to occur. As you suggest, the sins that the mining industry exhibited in the 2000 to 2011 period are still fresh in the minds of both managers and investors. And the consequence of that is that the industry thus far, with perhaps the mistake of the penny dreadful industry, the penny stocks, but the real mining stocks have been run prudently, perhaps too prudently in the last 10 years. One consequence of that is that they are generating cash flow in amounts that the industry has never seen before. And that cash will ultimately get spent. It will perhaps get spent on capital projects. It will perhaps get spent on mergers and acquisitions. It will certainly get spent on dividends, and it will probably be spent on share buybacks. All of those are good for the equities prices. Every single one of them, at least in the near term, is good for equities prices. So I believe that the metals will go higher because I believe that the metals compete with other forms of savings products, which don't work in this environment. I believe the equities will work, both because I believe that the metals prices will go higher, but also because I believe that they're fundamentally cheap, even at today's precious metals prices. So I think the answer to your question is yes and yes.
So Rick, I guess just to summarize all this, look, I do agree with you that debt, low interest rates, negative real interest rates, inflation, that ties in with the negative real interest rates. These should be key drivers to gold. And even with gold above, let's say, 1700 right now, it is still broadly higher than it has been through its history. However, it is off of its highs. But for that speculator, when they're seeing the equity markets and tech stocks and a wide range of other stocks continue to move higher, and then they look at their gold stocks or their silver stocks and see them continue to break down, especially over that last year, it does scare some investors away. I know that you always say investors should like lower prices. That means they're getting stock on sale. The problem is they've underperformed the markets for so long that it has driven away a wide range of investors and even pushed some other investors into some other newer markets like cryptocurrencies. Why do you think that is, and how does that actually get changed from the speculator standpoint?
It gets changed when it's too late, Corey. That's the way markets work. On your show 3 years ago, I was talking to your listeners, telling them, asking them to buy uranium stocks. I did everything but call their damn broker for them. That isn't what they wanted. They wanted pot stocks. There isn't much to be done in the near term for people who are inhabited by fear of missing out, or for people who propose to overpay. All I propose to do is be their pawnbroker. When an asset class I find is attractive is out of favor, I buy it aggressively. When it returns to favor, I sell it aggressively. It's interesting that the same people who I couldn't beat into buying uranium stocks when they were selling at a quarter of the current levels are now begging me for stock tips. That's the nature of human nature. It's why 90% of speculators are losers. It's why people go to Las Vegas casinos. There seems to be a determination on the part of most speculators to lose.
Well, Rick, that's an interesting place to pick up the uranium story because, of course, people are supposed to buy when it's low and sell when it's high, but they usually do just the opposite of that. But we've seen quite a move in the uranium market really over the last year and a half, but especially lately in lieu of the Sprott at the market financing and buying physical uranium in the spot market, as well as a number of non-producers, about a half dozen, also buying in the spot market, in addition to producers like Cameco and Ur Energy, also buying in the spot market. As a result, we've seen a pretty big move in the spot price recently, and a lot of the company valuations have skyrocketed even higher. You made an interesting remark in a recent interview, and I'd love you to touch on it again, about how this compares to the last uranium cycle as far as the company valuations and why you're not seeing as much upside now as you did at the beginning of that previous cycle.
Well, the first thing is that the easy money has been made in uranium. At $18 a pound, the price had to go up. It had to go up. It had to go up because the total industry average cost of production is about $60 a pound. So the industry'd make the stuff for 60. And when I say total cost, I don't just mean mine site cost. I mean exploration cost and cost of capital. The industry'd make the stuff for $60 a pound and sell it for 20, lose $40 a pound, and do it 130 million times a year. You know, that was a rather boring business. Offsetting that was the fact that uranium is an indispensable part of the way we live. And demand for electricity is growing, not declining, so it becomes more indispensable. And either the price of uranium had to rise to the level where the industry earned its cost of capital, or there wouldn't be any more uranium. And if there wasn't any more uranium in little tiny countries like the United States, the lights would go out. So that wasn't going to happen. The easy money has already been made. Now, I don't want to discourage people from being in the uranium business, because if you look forward 2 or 3 years, from $44, $45, $46 a pound, it is, to me, much more likely than not that the price goes up to $70 or $75 a pound, meaning that there is good money ahead if you have a 2 or 3 year horizon. But remember that the malaise that we've just experienced in precious metals and precious metals mining stocks can easily afflict the uranium business too. So if you aren't thinking in 2 or 3 year time frames, you need to begin to be cautious in the uranium space. And this market will be different than the last market for two primary reasons. The first reason is, as you suggest, the market capitalizations now are much higher. In the last uranium bull market, I counted it starting in 2000. Most people counted it starting in 2003. The market capitalizations in the junior space were infinitesimal. If I look back, I believe there were five juniors that survived a 20-year bear market. And in the ensuing bull market, the poorest performing of that collection of five went up 22 to 1. But part of the reason it went so high was that they started with market capitalizations that were absurdly low. Companies like the Canadian Strathmore, a $4 million market cap. International Uranium, run by the Lundins, with an $18 million market cap and $30 million cash in the treasury. The enterprise value was actually negative. Paladin Uranium, 1.6 million market cap. Very often now, the starting market caps of uranium juniors are 75 million or 100 million, which means if you look at the market caps that prevailed 2 decades ago, they've already achieved 10-bagger status relative to market cap. It's difficult to multiply to the same dimension a much larger starting market cap. The second thing that I think we all need to pay attention to is the emergence of a very powerful swing producer, Kazatomprom, which has an unusual ability to ramp up production in the 3 to 5 year time frame rather than the 10 to 15 year time frame that has beset traditional producers. One of the things that you note in natural resource-based businesses is that when the price of a commodity goes through the incentive price to produce it, the supply response isn't instantaneous because the industry needs to go through the permitting, the financing, and the building process to bring reserves onto production. In the case of Kazatomprom, you have unusual flexibility with regards to supply. That isn't to say that we aren't going to experience a continuation of this bull market and that there won't be really good money to be made. There will be, and I intend to participate it. But people who are looking at this market as having tenfold or 15-fold potential across the sort of length and breadth of the market are due to be disappointed.
Now, Rick, one of the key drivers, at least in the short term, to the uranium price, and this is after the stocks already ran. So something to consider. The uranium stocks definitely led before the uranium price started to move, but that is the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust that fairly aggressively went into the market and started buying a lot of that excess supply that was in that market. They weren't waiting around for, let's say, other companies to do that. They have played a pretty big role in moving that uranium price higher in the near term. How sustainable is this? How big of a deal is this in your eyes?
Corey, I need to plead guilty, first of all, to substantially underestimating the impact that our own product would have on my market. I had anticipated that when the Sprott Trust listed on the New York Stock Exchange, that the volumes would be such that the at-the-market could make a difference in the spot market. I hadn't understood how much more globalized securities markets are now, or frankly, how thin the spot market is. And I would suggest to you that 90% of the move in the spot market from $30 to a high of 50, now settling off in the high 40s, has been due to the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. It has been an overwhelming success from the point of view of the speculators who are in it, from the point of view of Sprott itself, and also from the point of view of the uranium industry. It's important to note that the spot market was beleaguered, which is to say, very few bidders and a lot of supply. A lot of the supply coming, I would suspect, from Japanese inventories themselves supply because of the shutdown of the Japanese nuclear fleet after Fukushima. The fact that there was a lot of supply overhang and no bidders meant that you had a market that was lower or directionless until a new bidder came in. And that new bidder changed everything. You will note that the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust can only buy new uranium inventories when it trades at a premium to net asset value. In other words, Sprott will not issue shares if they dilute existing holders. So today is an example where the trust is selling at a 1.5% discount to the net asset value, which on the one hand makes it a much better buy for speculators. They will not be issuing units, they will not be taking in new money, and they will not be buying physical supplies. But to the extent that fondness for the uranium narrative picks up again and flows come into the trust, they will again be, by their charter, in the money buying physical uranium supplies. I would suspect, given the shareholder composition of Sprott's other trusts in precious metals, where probably 90% of the shareholders in those physical precious metals trusts are Americans, that the listing of the Sprott Trust on the New York Stock Exchange, which I suspect will occur towards the end of the first calendar quarter in 2022, will continue to have a profound impact on uranium pricing. Note, too, that very, very recently, within the last month, there have been very encouraging noises coming out of Japan about a shifting of the political winds in favor of nuclear. The Japanese public, as well as the Japanese government, is coming to understand that the only prayer that Japan has of coming close to their Paris and Kyoto promises with regards to carbon generation will be to restart the nuclear fleet. Right now, as I understand it, something like 10 of 50 reactors are operating, which leaves 40 reactors down. The restart of the Japanese nuclear fleet, I suggest, would have a greater impact on the uranium price than the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust has.
Well, Rick, just one more question as we wrap up on uranium, and that is the contracting cycle. What we hope to see in the sector is the utility companies come back to the table with the producers or the development companies that could bring on production and start locking in those long-term offtake agreements, which is really what drives the longer-term pricing. Do you think we're getting closer to that with this recent price move? And has this moved things forward maybe by a year or two to get that contracting cycle started?
Yes and yes. The utilities had no incentive to enter into fixed price contracts at a uranium price which was required for the solvency of the miners, simply because there was so much material in the spot market, particularly Japanese material, that they could buy for substantially less. The circumstance now where the spot market has tightened up to the extent it has, and particularly if it keeps tightening, will be that the utilities will be forced to go into the term market. And by utilities, I mean utilities around the world. New built nuclear capacity, new reactors, which characteristically cost between $5 and $7 billion to build, as part of their financing documents, are increasingly required to secure fuel supplies for long enough to amortize the loans, which means that they can't rely on the spot market because the lenders don't want to rely on the spot market. So new build uraniums will almost by definition be term market buyers rather than spot market buyers. Because of the softness in the spot market and because of the ease with which utilities have been able to meet their near-term needs from the spot market, there has been a lot of the refueling cycle that has turned into informal or spot market refueling rather than term market refueling. I think that party's come to a screeching halt, as has, by the way, the carry trade. And I think, too, that the realization that 30 million pounds of supply has been locked away by Sprott, and there is an impending shift in Japanese inventories from material held for sale to material held for fuel, that utilities will need to rely on the term market. I think you will see transactions taking place pretty quickly between China General Nuclear and Kazatomprom, as an example. And you have heard, too, from Cameco that they have no intention of starting MacArthur or Cigar unless they get term contracts for enough supply that they can operate those facilities and earn a reasonable return on capital employed for their shareholders. So I think, yes, sooner rather than later, you're going to see a return of the term market.
All right, Rick, before we wrap it up here, I know that you have a special offer for everyone listening. Take us through that offer of looking at some of the stocks within some of our listeners' portfolio, please.
That offer is this. If you care about what I have to say about resources, but more importantly, the resource investments that you have made, if you visit a website, ruleinvestmentmedia.com, all one word, ruleinvestmentmedia.com, enter your natural resource stocks there. Please, by the way, no pot stocks. Please no crypto, please no tech stocks, just resource stocks. I'll rank those 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst. I will comment on individual issues where I think my comments might have value. And in addition, if you mention charts in the question and comment section, I will include the Barron's Gold Mining Index chart, which we referred to earlier, and a 100-year commodity chart, which talks about just how cheap commodities are relative to other asset classes going back 100 years. Once again, ruleinvestmentmedia.com.
All right. Thank you for that offer, Rick. I will post a link to that website to make it easier for everybody. And hey, Rick, great having you back on the show. I'm going to be reaching out to you a bit more regularly as hopefully this market starts turning here, but you have laid out some, I guess, long-term optimistic comments for all these precious metals investors. Everyone, stick around. We're going to be right back with Joe Mazumdar.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Rick Rule. In the next two segments, we're going to continue focusing on the resource and commodity sector as we are chatting now with Joe Mazumdar, editor of Exploration Insights. Now, Joe, it's been a while since I had you back on the show. It's great to have you back on. And since we haven't chatted in a little while, I do just want to get some broad comments from you starting on the precious metals. Very similar to how we started with Rick Rule on segment one here. There's no denying that the metals, precious metals, and the stocks have been under a lot of pressure. They just went through another pretty depressed month and quarter for that matter. Joe, what's your takeaway from this market right now, where it seems like we are back in an environment where sentiment is low and very few investors are actually even paying attention to the metal sector?
I mean, from a contrarian perspective, this would be the time for those people to actually, peak. This would be the time to pique your interest. With respect to the negative sentiment in the gold sector or the precious metal sector, it's being really led by the Federal Reserve in the U.S. Talking about cutting out the tapering, and then potential for an increase in real rates, which is what everybody's watching. Every impact people are looking at is getting back down to real rates. And so if they see, even if real rates stay negative, but the trend is, let's say negative 6.6% to 0%, for those guys, that's negative. If they're seeing positive 0.6% going to negative 0.6%, that's great for them, and they want to be in the gold sector. What we've been seeing, and what a BlackRock executive said several weeks ago before the Precious Metal Summit in Colorado, was that, they had a significant position in the gold sector last year in 2020, around the time when gold peaked. But now their position is basically almost zero. So that is the generalist investor that all the mega mergers and all that combinations were there to attract. Like, hey, we've got the market cap, we've got the liquidity, we generate free cash flow, we issue dividends, just think of us as any other company. But the problem is that the generalist doesn't need to be in the gold sector. They see the gold sector as part of their investment, macro investment thesis, that gold is good to be in because rates are negative and are going to stay negative for a while. When that changes, they leave the sector. And even if you comparatively may be the best in your sector, it doesn't matter. They're not interested in that sector. And so that negativity has basically impacted the entire sector. So the sector weakness is basically being led, and you can see it from the producers and the equity side of it, and less so from the gold price. And the gold price is still at a good spot, at around 1750, when some major producers are still booking reserves at 1200, 1250. And balance sheet wise, net debt positions are much more favorable than they were in the last cycle when gold peaked at about 1960. And, now what we've just seen with another mega merger between Kirkland and Agnico is the industry saying that, we're still interested in scale. And we're still interested in, basically generating more value and attracting generalists. So there's obviously a dichotomy between the way the industry thinks of where they are and how good they're doing versus investors. I would say the biggest risk right now for the producing side of it is what I've seen looking at about 15 or 20 companies, looking at their profit margins from last quarter, from the June quarter versus Q3 last year, is what I've seen. It's obviously a bit of a drop in the revenue because of the gold price, but you're seeing a cost creep on average of 10 to 15% that's having a negative impact on their margins. They're still doing relatively well, but they're doing less well.
Now, Joe, what do you think it's going to take to turn sentiment more towards some of these stocks? Because, the argument has been that the majors are generating some nice cash flow. However, the problem being is that their costs are creeping up and the metal they're selling has also been trending downward. For the exploration stocks, there's just no interest. It seems like even good news can be a reason for investors to sell. So what is going to change this broad ignoring of the sector?
Well, I think on the industry side, if we see more M&A like we're seeing with the Kirklands and Agnico on the major side, if that pervades and trickles down to the non-cash flowing resource companies, that's what will pick it up. Is that when we're seeing quality companies getting taken out, that's what will change sentiment. But like you said, that at least in the North American market, a good drill result or a strong catalyst can still be a liquidity moment for people just to escape the sector, which wasn't what was happening, obviously, several months ago or more. it's different on the ASX. I still see companies there that are putting out good results that are still seeing a good reaction, positive reaction in the market.
Well, Joe, another subsector and stage of the miners that have really gotten beat up are the development stage companies, because A, we haven't seen that big push in M&A, but also I think some investors have gotten bored with them in that orphan stage where they're doing the permitting and the construction and the financing. But you had made a great point the other day about companies that can reinvent themselves and get more focused on exploration, even if they're a developer, and you had used Liberty Gold as an example. I'd love you to unpack that for our audience and how that could reignite the investor interest in companies like that.
Yeah, so we're all probably familiar with the Lassonde curve and an exploration company coming up to basically converting into the development stage in the fall, like you said, about the orphan stage prior to getting into production. But and Liberty Gold was on that path. They produced a resource, a new resource at their Black Pine open pit heap leach gold project in the southeastern part of Idaho, which is the northeastern part of the Great Basin, which includes a lot of Carlin-style deposits, which this is one of them. They were all about exploration, and their stock had done really well. And then after releasing the 2 million ounces, which just barely met, I would say, investors' expectations, and then going into a negative sentiment in the gold sector, the stock has pulled back significantly. And I think some of it was also attributable to the fact that they were talking about putting a scoping study and then moving to a pre-feasibility study. And so then the retail sector that is less entranced with that sort of de-risking catalyst, they pulled out. But what they've done now is last year they permitted a new area under cover, sandstone cover, that where they have the same package of the stratigraphy that hosts the gold mineralization where they've drilled right now, and they've got the 2 million ounces. They found it in another place called the Range Front, and now they've expanded their drill program from drilling up to 40,000 to maybe 60 to 80,000 meters. And so that, I would say, should get retail more excited about the stock, because now it's sort of gone back on the Lassonde curve to more of an exploration play, to saying, hey, maybe we got more resource here before we put a pin in it and do a scoping study.
Joe, are you enticed at all by any of these explorers out there right now that have these large programs? Because we went through this massive financing window. All the juniors, or pretty much all the juniors, cashed up, and then they went out there and started spending that money. A lot of them putting that money into the ground. Unfortunately, that backed up the assay labs, and now they're releasing news in a pretty depressed market. What does excite you about any sort of exploration plays right now?
Well, for me, I mean, I would say, like, it's thick intersections of continuous mineralization. That's what would excite me. And I see that in some of these companies, and those are the companies I continue to hold, because I think that there's something there that's legitimate that another company would want. And that's what's driving most of the companies I continue to hold. The other reason I continue to hold some of my companies is because they're like a liquidity trap and I couldn't get out of them if I wanted to. But
I hear you, Joe. I hear you, buddy.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir here. So yeah, the ones that I continue to speak volumes about in the letter are those that I think they have a legitimate chance of constructing a resource and a deposit that I think somebody else would want. So that underlying M&A, which would be more sector driven and not investor driven, is really what I'm focused. What Exploration Insights always focused on, but now it even comes more to the forefront.
Joe, how are you handling companies where there's a lot of these, I can think of a couple dozen just offhand, that have very large drill programs because they finally got cashed up a year or two ago. They've deployed the most drills on their property that they have. Some of these companies are doing 30,000, 50,000, 80,000, even 100,000 meters. And so they're massive drill programs, and they're continuing to put out results that are solid, but not really moving the needle much. And what's happening is these companies are growing their market cap, but their share price really isn't going up. And so that might help the company, and that might help some company officers, but it's not helping investors. How do you deal with those kind of value traps?
Yeah, well, the problem is, like you said, is the share structure. I mean, if people just follow market cap, a lot of these companies do double in market cap. But if you notice, the share price doesn't change because they constantly issue equity. Or they've also got warrants that come in, give them money, but at a 30% discount to where they're trading. So, yeah, the underlying issue is that, you know, as an investor, we don't own a royalty. We don't own a piece of the asset. We own a piece of the company. And so we should be as concerned about the value in the numerator and the number of shares in the denominator. And so an overly dilutive company, you know, on a share basis, you may not make any money because, again, you own the share of the company, but you don't own the asset. So you got to constantly think about dilution. But in this market, you know, people are not that patient with expiration programs, not that they ever were. The, you know, these programs take 2 to 3 years. And the problem in the market is, you know, when after you finish your first 6 to 8 month program, and now the assays are even later, and you're not getting them, it's hard to go back to the market and say, okay, we're going to need more for the next program. But right now you haven't had all the assay results, and so your share price really hasn't moved. And so do you go to the market now, or are you going to wait till January, February, when everybody else is going to go up? It's because everybody's waiting 8 weeks for their assay results. So you're right. It's something that's happening everywhere, it seems, in North America. And it's probably a little better in parts of Africa and Europe and Australia. But yeah, it's a phenomenon that's not only impacting, you know, share price performance, but in their ability to return to the equity markets, as most of these non-cash flowing junior explorers have to almost every year.
Yeah, that's so true. And those assay labs, it's just disappointing because there's a lot of good work going on. And companies need to get the assays back to guide some of their future drilling, too. So
yes, I mean, that's important. Sector. That's important as well, because if a company is doing an infill program like 50 meter spacing or even 25 or less to, you know, upgrade something from mineralization to inferred category or inferred to indicated, that's easy to do and you don't need the assays, really. You're just going to drill that next hole because that's what the drill pattern suggests. The problem is more in the grassroots where you're drilling 4 or 5 holes and then you're saying, okay, did I hit it? And then if you've got gold mineralization, which is not visible, which most a lot of times it's not, you don't know if you should drill more in this area or that area. And so that means paying people standby while you're waiting for results or moving the rig somewhere else because you just don't have the results to follow up. Otherwise, you're sort of drilling blind.
So, Joe, before we leave the precious metals, just real quick, are you more biased or do you like gold explorers better or silver explorers better in this environment?
Silver is just, you know, more leverage. I mean, the thing is that there's very few pure silver plays out there, such that if you find one that's high grade and, you know, has a high potential to become a deposit, that should be coveted because there are so few of those. I'm not talking silver equivalent. I'm just talking about pure silver. And that's just the nature of geology. There's just not a lot of those types of deposits. So, yes, but there's so few of those. You know, if one of those drops significantly, that's something that you should consider owning, you know, like a Mag Silver or something like that, or a silver crest. On the gold side, there's more gold deposits, gold potential, but then you got to think a little bit strategically in that where do the mid-tiers and the majors want to be? Which jurisdictions do they prefer? You know, is there a plant nearby that they have to feed? And so some of the M&A that we saw last year was incremental, that they had a plant running out of feed and another company had a resource and they thought, well, I could take this and stick it into my plant. So I'll take that. Thank you very much. And so because it's taking longer to permit, you know, in some areas, you know, having that plant is even more strategic now. And if you can get a resource, which doesn't have to be a standalone even now, that could feed those plants, that's another thing that you could potentially see with M&A.
Well, Joe, just shifting focus now over to the battery metal space. We saw a pretty big run in a lot of them, copper, nickel, even some of the lithium, and you could argue that uranium stocks are in the energy metals. But just specifically on copper, I know you follow the copper space pretty well, and we had a nice run in copper this year, and the producers and the mid-tier producers ran first like we normally see, but the junior miners in copper stocks really didn't get much love, and we had talked off mic about it, and you had a couple good reasons as to why you thought that was about where they're at in this cycle. I'd love to get your thoughts on the copper miners, in particular the copper juniors.
Yeah, I mean, the copper juniors, I mean, there have been some, copper plays that have done well, and led by grade, but I'm not sure if they would ever become deposits. I have seen some of those, but I own one that's a developer where they don't have to put in another penny into the joint venture, and it's a relatively high grade deposit in Alaska, and I can see that being taken out. But is there any impetus for that company to take them out at this point, when potentially nobody else would want them? I don't know. But the problem right now is that, in 10 years, when we hit, the paucity of copper production, there's just no projects right now that would feed into that pipeline. And so for us to get an Exploration Insights, to get a junior that's exposed to a copper development project that could potentially feed that supply shortfall, that's hard to get. And that's what I'm looking for. And I'm willing to be patient with those because I know those will turn, retail might not like it because it's not putting out the sexy results, but that's for me a long-term hold. I'm very willing to hold on to that. I also play in copper exploration. The problem with copper exploration in a junior is it's much more expensive than gold. You may have to drill more holes. You might have to drill deeper. And it might not always be possible for a junior to raise those kind of funds perpetually to drill out copper plays. Maybe you could do it on a VMS, a volcanic massive sulfide deposit, which is lower ton and higher grade, but it's more difficult for a porphyry or a sediment-hosted style deposit, which can be kilometers and kilometers. So I would prefer maybe a joint venture partner that was helping a company and saw it more as a 3 to 5 year play.
Well, Joe, what are your thoughts on some of the other copper juniors that really have polymetallic deposits, or there's some that are just copper and gold, and they may be smaller scale, not require the massive capex to get them built like the pure copper plays, but they're in North America, maybe they're in good parts of Australia, but they have the gold credits to make them worth the candle on the precious metal side. Do you like that kind of hybrid gold copper play if it's a junior explorer developer?
Well, the market definitely does. But the question is then who would want it? Is it for a copper company, or is it too small tonnage for a copper company, or does it have too much copper for a gold company, or is it a blend? Because some people, like if it's got 60% revenue on the copper side and it's got gold, silver, lead, zinc, there are intermediate base metal producers that would definitely love those kind of projects because they get a bit of diversity in the metal, maybe that they could take a stream on the byproduct to help fund them. So I'm sure that there's interest, but potentially not by a major producer, but potentially by some smaller mid-tier producers.
So Joe, when you look at the copper space broadly, and there is some good exploration going on, but I think there's also a handful, maybe even 10 to a dozen of these de-risk projects that are lower grade copper, but they do have a large resource and they do show decent economics. However, they're a big price tag to build, and some of them are in good jurisdictions, some are not in the best jurisdictions. Either way, though, there seem to be a number of these assets just sitting there. Do you think that's a hamper on the copper market as well? Because there are millions of pounds that are proved up, but just not getting pulled out of the ground.
Yeah, the thing is that with copper, those it's just like any commodity. You'll have a lot of marginal deposits out there that are always sitting on the sidelines waiting for the gold price or whatever price, commodity price, to change. The problem with a lot of these assets, and I've done the math on some of them, is that when when the commodity price changes such that you think that they'd be economic, and then you start, you know, adjusting your costs, your operating costs and your capital costs, a lot of the times you find that the return on that capital doesn't change much, you know. But saying that, you know, the Rio Tinto investment into Western copper and gold was interesting to me, because here's this, you know, relatively low grade copper gold project in the Yukon that's infrastructurally challenged. But, you know, the resource is well established. Management team is good. You know, jurisdiction is good. But, you know, it's infrastructurally challenged, and, you know, it's got a high capital ticket and marginal grade. But Rio Tinto went into it. And is that being led by the fact that Rio Tinto is having problems in Mongolia expanding into the underground at Oyu Tolgoi? Is it related to the fact that, you know, Peru is, you know, potentially increasing taxes and royalties there? You know, Chile might do the same, you know, and then jurisdictionally it's harder to permit some places, like they're having problems in Superior with their resolution project. Are they thinking that, hey, you know, I'm willing to take the lower return on the copper grade for the better risk profile and actually developing the project, because these people actually want it to be developed, you know? So that jurisdictional thing, and I'm jurisdiction, people think, oh, the DRC or something. Jurisdiction can also be Arizona. You know, that could be a big risk. So, you know, I'm sure companies are contemplating that, because you could have a really great deposit, as they have with Resolution. And when I worked for Phelps Dodge as a market analyst in 2003, I had that project coming into production in 2010. It's now 2021, and I'm not sure how much closer it is to coming into production.
Fair. I think a lot of people are also sitting on the sidelines saying, well, when, if any of these companies or projects are going to get back into some sort of advancement, really, because they've been kind of sitting dormant for a while. Let's get a quick couple comments on uranium, because look, this year, uranium stocks going through a major run, and then finally uranium started to play catch up, but a lot of that was simply on the back of the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust going into that open market and buying the excess uranium. That is driving price up. That'll happen when you have a big buyer enter a market, but how sustainable is that in your eyes, and do you think that uranium stocks have topped?
So in terms of uranium, like we know, is that, you know, there's a lot of inventory of uranium that companies meaning the reactors, have been going through, and hence their hesitancy to sign long-term multi-year contracts at higher prices. And so those inventories aren't readily transparent to everybody, how much people are holding, how many weeks of inventory everyone has. But, you know, the difference between the spot and the last long-term contracts that were signed were significant. At what point? Like $20 to $30 per pound difference. And basically you had this match between the producers and the reactors and the power companies saying, okay, well, I'm not going to sign one. And the other is going, I'm not going to sign one unless it's, you know, oh, well over $50. And so nothing ever happened. And I know from Energy Fuels' perspective, they're not, before this run-up, they had no intention of signing a long-term contract under these prices. And that's probably the same for a lot of these companies. So now, if now we're forecasting that, okay, $50 is what it's going to be, or 60 to 70, it might be what we need for new projects. You know, will what's happening now in the market lead these energy producers to say basically, okay, I better sign a long-term contract because the gap between the long-term contracts and the spot is closer now, and then I take de-risk myself. So whether that happens, I don't know if that's like in a year or 2 years. I know we're getting closer to this inventory being taken out, but these guys seem to be taking a risk and sitting on their hands a bit longer, and that might happen for another 6 months to a year. I'm not sure. It's obviously had a very good impact on uranium equities from exploration to the producers. Whether it's sustainable, that will all depend on whether these energy producers actually turn around and the reactors say, okay, now we'll start signing long-term contracts. And then the producers say, well, okay, but I want $70. So that's going to be really where this market phenomenon in uranium becomes more sustainable. I have yet to see that, and that's something I'm looking for. I hold a uranium stock with the idea that that's coming, but I can tell you before this uranium move, that company was doing better because of the idea of using its plant to produce rare earths as well.
Yeah, Joe, you bring up an interesting point too on the long-term contracting cycle, because let's just say that some of these pundits that are saying that's gotten a lot closer now with all the spot price movement higher, that maybe they'll come to the table with the producers and the developers and say, okay, let's do some long-term offtake contracts. But if they do it at, let's say, $60, and then those companies bring production on, what about all the other, you know, 40 to 50 explorers and developers that have run so hard, so fast? Could there be the risk of this just plateauing at that long-term contract price, let's say $60, $65? And has most of the move already been baked into these smaller companies at this point?
Well, I would say they're probably ahead of themselves right now, some more so than others. I would say that, depending on the type of plant that you're running, whether it's conventional or an ISR, I mean, you could probably get away with a 50 to 60 long-term contract and make a $20 per pound margin and say that's good enough for a restart, which doesn't require a lot of upfront capital. I could see people signing those contracts, but they wouldn't be for a lot of volume. It wouldn't be a huge amount of volume. Then the question becomes, like, does Kazakhstan come back to the levels that it had before? Is there anything left in their ISR? I know China's, they've been buying and growing resources in Africa and other places where people won't go. And most of those deposits require $70 plus. Because in the end, China knows who the customer is. It's them. So do they want to wait until they need it to start acquiring it? No, they've been acquiring it already. So then the question becomes, everybody else, where are you going to get it from? Yeah, that's really the question.
All right, Joe, we're going to wrap it up here. I really appreciate you taking the time wrapping up this weekend edition for us. It's great having you back on the show. Everybody, thank you for tuning in to the weekend edition here. And again, please go back through the week on our website and check out a lot of those company interviews that we took part in, as well as some of the other analyst commentary throughout the week. It was an important week for that monthly and quarterly close for the metals. Unfortunately, another down week, but look, there are a lot of stocks that have gotten quite cheap, so make sure that you're in the ones that are doing the good work, and especially right now, do have the cash to keep moving forward. Joe, really appreciate your time, buddy. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Great. Thanks a lot.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment.